been discussing a couple of things, but I'm going to start just do a quick run through of some of the main points, and then we can open to questions. Is that okay? Or if everybody's read everything, we can skip the first part. I'll just do a quick overview. But one of the things I was just mentioning was that, you know, one of the reasons we did this paper is that people have been predicting this kind of gloom and doom for the Venezuelan economy since the beginning of the recovery in February of 2003, when the oil strike ended. And in fact, I didn't put this in the paper, but the press reports and the analysts, I should say, it wasn't really the press's fault, it was the analysts that they were quoting way overestimated the time that it would take to even restore oil production. But the IMF projections for 2004, 2005, and 2006 underestimated GDP growth by 10.6, 6.8, and 5 percentage points, respectively, for those 3 years. So that's one of the main reasons we wrote this paper, because maybe there were some misconceptions of what was going on in the overall economy. So I think the big thing, first of all, if you want to look at, you know, what happened in the last 8 years, you really have to, I think, divide it into two periods, because the first 4 years were really a period of political instability, severe political instability, culminating, of course, in 2002 with the military coup, and then later that year, the oil strike, which caused a terrible recession and knocked 24% of GDP out of the economy in that recession. That's kind of comparable to the initial crash in the Great Depression for the United States. It's a really enormous drop. So, and then this is all in Figure 2. It shows some of the main political events. I won't go through them, but you can see, if you look at the graph, or I can describe, you know, since the end of the oil strike in February, if you just look at the quarterly GDP, it's just the level of GDP, it's been straight up. Of course, the initial burst in the second quarter of 2003 is mainly restoring oil production. But then from then on, it's the non-oil economy that leads for most of the recovery. And you can see it's been a straight-up growth, very rapid, a total, a cumulative total since the bottom of 76%. So this is a huge, this is more than just a bounce back. This is a very, very, very rapid and sustained growth. And I think it's because, you know, political stability returned to the country. In about May of 2003 is when the opposition reached an agreement with the government that they were going to seek to get rid of Chavez through a peaceful means, legal means, through the referendum process. And then everything, you know, from then on, political stability really increased. The economy's been growing the whole time. So I would attribute the growth not only to the increase in oil prices, but also to the macroeconomic policies, which were highly expansionary, both fiscal and monetary policies. And also, as we talked about just at the beginning of this call, I think the exchange controls were effective in stemming some of the capital flight. Somebody just call in. You can announce yourself as you come in. Anybody who's... Okay. All right. So... So that's, you know, that's the first thing, I think. Now, given that, you know, there were also, obviously, I went through in the paper a lot of the huge increase in government spending to 30% of GDP, but revenues increased faster, so you ended up with a balanced budget last year. And you had a huge increase in social spending as well. This is, you know, we looked at the social, well, we looked at it various ways, but, you know, no matter how you look at it, it's very, very big, from, you know, 8.3% of the economy of GDP to over 13%. And then that doesn't include the PDVSA spending, which was about 13.3 billion last year, or another 7.3% of GDP. So altogether, it's about 20.9% of GDP, which is an awful lot for any economy that's about the size of our whole federal budget relative to the U.S. economy. So it's not surprising that you see some, you know, greatly increased provision of health care services, the subsidized food, the education. A lot of it, actually, social spending was increased Social Security pension, state pension payments as well. So that, I think, was one of the big things that obviously not only increased the government's popularity, but also was part of the gains from this kind of economic growth. There's a couple different stories for why the economy might be headed for a bust. I mean, some of it's kind of vague, you know, it's just the idea that this is an oil boom, and then it has to go bust. I mean, oil prices are not likely to decline any time in the foreseeable future, at least according to all the projections that we have out there. And, of course, there are other reasons, which we all know. The instability in the Middle East puts most of the risks of changes in oil prices on the upside. But even if it were to decline, you can see from the figures on reserves, you know, Venezuela's reserves are enough, even not counting the offshore accounts, it's enough to pay off their almost their entire foreign debt. About 26 billion. There's another 14 billion in offshore accounts that are not counted in official reserves, but it will also be available to the government. So you could have quite a large, you know, I said 20%, but it's probably much bigger than that, decline in oil prices, and the government could just take care of that with by dipping into reserves. If they ever had to go beyond that, they can borrow on international markets because their foreign debt is so low relative to the past and relative to other countries. It's about 14.6% of GDP, which is pretty low foreign public debt. So they're not, you know, it's hard to imagine an oil price collapse. And again, in the foreseeable future, anything's possible many, you know, years from now. But in the foreseeable future, it's hard to imagine an oil price collapse that would bring, that would cause serious trouble for the government. I mean, you could imagine government spending being reduced some, growth slowing a little, but not putting an end to the expansion. So there's a couple other stories, too, you could tell, that would bring an end to the expansion. The one I think is actually the most serious one, but it's an intermediate run to long run story, and not an immediate threat, is the inflation exchange rate story. So if you want, I can go through that a little bit. Would you all like for me to explain that a little? Is that something you'd want to look at? Anybody?
Hello?
Yeah.
Just want to make sure everybody's here.
And can you hear us okay?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, so I guess the biggest threat to the economy in the intermediate run is you have a high rate of inflation, and the inflation itself is not that much of a threat just yet. You have to remember that inflation was falling remarkably through most of this huge expansion of the last 4 years. It fell from 40%. At the end of the oil strike in 2003 to about 10% a year ago, and then it's been rising, and now it's back up to 19%, 19.4, and that, you know, is too high. Of course, it's above the way above the government's target, but again, in historical perspective, you know, compared to 100% inflation in 1996, 40% in 1998. It's still, and given that, again, it's only been rising over the last year, it's nowhere near a situation where inflation is out of control. It's just kind of reaching the level where, you know, a good part of the macroeconomic literature says that it could hurt growth. and it could become a problem if it obviously if it does get out of control. So the inflation is not so much of a problem itself, although it is something that the government's got to do something about, and I describe in the paper some of the things that they are doing. But what is, I think, the problem is that the combination of inflation of this level, or even close to this level, with a fixed nominal exchange rate, that appreciates the real exchange rate. So they have an overvalued currency. And that's bad for the tradable sector of the economy, especially in manufacturing. And that's a long-run problem, especially if the government wants to, as they say they do, diversify away from oil. Now, Venezuela is not the only country with an overvalued currency and has this problem. Brazil is another example of a way overvalued currency. And that's hurting their manufacturing sector. It's a similar thing. They have commodities exports, so they can maintain this. But it really is bad for their industry, for their manufacturing, and the whole tradable goods sector and their overall development. This is the same thing is true for Venezuela. And same thing's true for the United States, for that matter. We've lost 3 million manufacturing jobs since 2001 because of our overvalued currency. But all these countries have different situations in terms of how long you can have a situation like that and how much damage it does. And so right now it hasn't done that much damage. I mean, the manufacturing sector during this current economic expansion has grown by a little over 90%. So it's a little bit faster than the overall recovery. So it's not being crushed the way it was, you know, for example, when Argentina's currency was overvalued in the 90s. And, of course, the government can maintain this for as long as they want because they have the huge reserves and the current account surplus. So, again, it's different from situations of overvalued fixed exchange rates you had in the 90s, like Argentina and Brazil and Russia, where, you know, you could... And we, of course, did predict the imminent collapse of those currencies. This is not going to happen in Venezuela. The government will eventually devalue, and it'll devalue at the pace that it chooses. And so this is a serious thing, though, because, as I said, each year that goes by when you have a double-digit inflation, you're appreciating the exchange rate by not quite that much, of course, because there's some inflation in the U.S., but you're appreciating it by quite a bit, and that is bad for the economy. So that's the challenge they're going to have. They have a lot of tools and a lot of leeway to deal with it. But in the meantime, I think they have been correct in making the priority being economic growth, that is, accepting the uptick in inflation in order to keep the recovery going. Same thing that Argentina has done, and I think that that's why I think. I mean, I look at also, you know, the government's commitment to economic growth, and I see. I think if I were to predict the next few years, which is of course impossible to predict, but I would say that, you know, that it's more likely than not that the growth will continue. The government will take some measures to reduce inflation. Some of those may slow growth, but they're not going to do the kind of orthodox route that you've seen so often in Latin America over the last 25 years, which is to really sacrifice the growth of the economy altogether to bring down inflation. Okay, why don't I leave it there and see what kind of questions and discussion people want to have.
Mark?
Yes.
Yes, this is Maria from FA News Services. I just have one question because I read most of the report. Obviously, it gives the Venezuelan government and its political economy high marks, and obviously, it's going to be good for foreign investment as well. So, I wanted to ask you about what the timing of this report is, and whether or not it has political implications.
The timing of the report is compared to what?
What's the timing? Why are you releasing the report now, and whether or not this will have political implications for Venezuela?
Oh, well, we just released it now because I finally had time to finish this paper. There was no timing at all. As a matter of fact, I don't even know if this is, I didn't actually think about whether this is a good or a bad time for a paper like this.
Yeah, and this is something we've been working on actually for several months, the research side of it especially.
I mean, that's not to say we don't normally, actually. I mean, we do try to actually time our papers with something that's in the news, but we just didn't do it this time.
Okay. No, but what I was wondering, though, is that, you know, because a lot of, you know, there are a lot of tensions between the U.S. government and Chavez, and, you know, he's been accused of all sorts of things, and how he's a bad influence in the region. And by showing that this political economy is somehow averting, you know, bigger problems and sort of like a model, I was wondering if you perceive that I was using this as a political tool to respond to its critics.
Well, I'm not putting the Venezuelan economy as a model for anything at all. I mean, first of all, it wouldn't be applicable anywhere else. This is an oil state and an oil economy. So I think all we're really trying to do here is present a realistic picture of something that has been, I think, misunderstood in the last few years. This is, as I said to James at the beginning of the call, this is what we do generally at CEPR in our domestic economic work as well. We did a lot of, we were the first to do the arithmetic of the stock market bubble, for example, in the late 90s, and actually the only economists in the country to do that. And the same was true for the housing bubble, which is now bursting. We warned about that for several years. So we tend to be ahead of the curve, and we try to pick the big issues that we think other people are missing. And this is an easy one to miss because nobody really likes this government. And most of the reporting has been very pessimistic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, let's take some more questions.
Hi, this is Stefan at Dow Jones. I have two questions. One is relatively basic. What is your judgment of the quality of economic data that's now readily available in Venezuela? Because you hear a lot of complaints about that, so, and hence a lot of issues going from even the rate of inflation to, above all, the amount of investment that's actually going on. That leads into my second question, which would be, a lot of people say there's not much fixed capital investment going on in the private sector. While things are fine and companies are happy with their earnings, the political noise regarding constitutional reform and the threat of nationalization is, they say, limiting investment. And I don't really feel there's data that one can be confident with to prove this. So I would like to know your views on that, on those two issues.
Yeah, you know, those are both good questions. I actually was going to do that at the beginning. First of all, the quality of the data overall, we haven't seen any real problems in terms of the data that's available. And this was an issue, you know, we did a previous paper on the poverty data because there was quite a, I mean, you know, we documented it in the paper. It's you can see this paper on our website. But, there was for a couple of years after it was clearly false, almost all the media, and including journals like Foreign Policy and Foreign Affairs, were saying that poverty had increased under Chavez. And the data showed the opposite. And so we wrote that paper, and it turned out that, and everyone stopped saying it. As a result of that paper. And at that time, there was the Financial Times even reported that there was something wrong with the data, that had the National Institute of Statistics, the INE, had actually changed their methodology for measuring poverty. And of course, that was just completely wrong. There was no change in methodology. They're measuring only cash income, and that's what they've done from the beginning. And so we did have a consistent series. The World Bank also uses that series. There was nothing wrong with it. So, in fact, and of course, as we showed in the paper, you know, you expect poverty to drop quite rapidly, even more rapidly than it has, in an expansion of this kind. This is what almost always happens. So the reduction in the poverty rate was completely consistent with what we knew was going on in the economy and with other data. There was no reason to question the data except for the fact that there was this rumor out there that there was something wrong with it. So I just give that as an example because we're, you know, we're pretty fussy about data and we always look at how it's measured. So on the investment data, you have a problem that you don't have a division on gross fixed capital formation. You don't have any breakdown for the last...
In private, yeah.
Yeah, for 2005 and 2006. Yeah, we will get it. I'm not sure when. But you do have it for 2004, the first year of the recovery, and I put it in the paper. The private capital formation rebounded even faster than public. It was gross fixed private capital formation grew by 139% in 2004 over 2003, and the public sector grew by 49%. So the first year, at least, of that rebound, we know was led by the private sector capital formation. Now, this could have reversed itself. We, you know, by now, it's quite possible. We know, for example, that foreign direct investment was negative last year. And the media focuses a lot on foreign direct investment, and that's understandable because they're writing for, you know, U.S. or European audiences. But we should keep it in perspective. I mean, foreign direct investment, you know, when it was positive, was only about 1.8% of GDP, which is significant. But as a percentage of gross capital formation, it's not that much. So it's not going to, I mean, the future, you know, the near future and probably even the long-term future of Venezuela's growth and development is not going to be determined by what happens to foreign direct investment.
Okay, let's take another question.
Mark, it's John from the Journal. You know, you make, you know, pretty good arguments as, you know, why the, you know, the overall numbers for Venezuela look good. You know, growth, you know, was far faster than the IMF or anyone else like that predicted. And, you know, I think you make the right arguments, certainly, as to why some kind of, you know, dramatic devaluation is not imminent because of the surplus, as you mentioned. But, you know, looking at the... my question is about kind of the opening statement where, you know, it seems that the purpose of the paper is to debunk this commonly held view that it's an oil boom driven by high prices, as in the past, and is headed for a bust. And I mean, the arguments in the paper that Venezuela is not headed for a bust, as I understand them, are that, well, oil isn't going to decline for the foreseeable future. But, you know, could be years, probably will be years, and also when it does decline, Venezuela has some cushion that it will be able to use to soften the blow, reserves and the ability to borrow. But those don't seem to be arguments debunking that. That an oil boom will bust. They seem to be arguments that an oil boom will last longer than people expect. I was kind of looking for some kind of for more arguments related to the problems in the real economy. Arguments as to why the kind of economy that Chavez is setting up is sustainable, attacking the complaints that, for example, actual volume production of oil at PDVSA is declining. How do you deal with problems like that? The questions about the kinds of jobs that are being created as you lower unemployment and reduce the poverty rates. I mean, the bulk of the jobs, at least anecdotally, don't seem to be jobs that are going to multiply, create their own momentum within the economy, such as the jobs that are being created in the Misiones, etc. While they're very beneficial right now for the people that are benefiting from those services, they don't have the kind of long-term sustainability that new manufacturing sectors or other types of long-term sustainable jobs might create. So I guess I'd like to hear your kind of response to that. I mean, I was hoping for a little bit more on the criticisms of what's happening in the real economy rather than the kind of the academic outlook of the macro numbers, which you know, right? I think you make good arguments. They have been misinterpreted or at least pessimistically interpreted over the years, and you're making a strong argument that those pessimistic and that pessimistic analysis didn't turn out to be right. But there is kind of a I think for the long term, especially for the people living there, you know, who plan to, you know, retire there and have children there, the long-term sustainability of the real economy is now a real question.
Well, first of all, the macro economy is the real economy, and we did provide in the table on employment, which I can't remember what page it is, I'll find it in a minute, but you know, I think I mentioned at the beginning of the call, maybe, you know, the formal sector employment is now 49%, 49 point something, and informal is around 41. That's a significant drop. So the jobs being created are more in the formal sector. So in 1998, the breakdown, well, we can take 1999 if we want, but, you know, either one. The breakdown was much worse. In 99, it was 40.7 in the formal sector and 44.8 in the informal. So you've had quite an increase, a significant increase in the jobs in the formal sector. So that shows that there is an improvement in the quality of jobs. The drop in the unemployment rate, with measured unemployment, is quite significant as well. From, you know, the beginning, pre-Chavez, it was about 15%. It's down to about 8%, which is the lowest level in the decade. So, you know, economies change and they develop in a direction that's permitted. You know, in the United States, for example, during the boom we had in the 1990s, which was the longest running business cycle expansion we had, you know, you could question the sustainability of our growth as well, given the massive foreign debt that we've piled up and everything else. But the main thing is, you know, you lost manufacturing jobs because of our overvalued currency and our trade policies, but you expanded in the service sector. And that wouldn't have been my preferred development strategy, but on the other hand, it was, you know, it was something that worked in a certain way. And I'm actually not arguing that the current policies are sustainable. I did say very clearly in the paper that something has to be done about the exchange rate. Because, you know, for a developing country, it's a more serious problem than it is for us. Because you know, they actually have to try to build their manufacturing sector, build their tradable goods sector, non-traditional exports, non-oil exports. They're not going to be able to do that with this kind of a currency. So in that sense, the current recovery is not, the current expansion is not sustainable over the long run. But again, what my main argument is that it's not going to break down. It's not going to collapse because the government has, it's only been a few years. I think they've concentrated in the last few years on sustaining the rapid growth and providing, you know, increased access to health care, food, and education. And now they have to go to the next phase, which means some real development planning and diversifying the economy. In terms of oil production, I didn't talk about it in this paper because it's too, a much bigger subject, but I've seen no evidence so far that oil production is in jeopardy. That, in other words, that Venezuela will actually lose revenue, government revenue, or the economy will lose growth because they can't produce as much oil as they want to produce. The reason, most recent cuts were to comply with OPEC quotas. I don't believe the data that is reported in the press. I think the government data is probably closer to the truth on how much they're producing. But I haven't been able, we're going to try and do a little issue brief like we did on the poverty numbers. But again, I don't see a crisis in the oil sector. I think it's the same as the other kind of reporting. It's highly exaggerated. It's been exaggerated all along, as I said before, from the beginning of the oil strike. Everybody thought it was going to take forever for them to even recover production after the oil strike. So I left that out of the paper because it's a separate subject, and I didn't see any evidence that the macro picture is really influenced in the foreseeable future by oil production. I think they're going to produce as much oil as they want to produce given their participation in OPEC and the prices that they want to see on the world market. But
Do you think they've set their targets, though, that's sort of possibly artificially low in order that they can guarantee achieving them?
Targets for oil production?
Yeah.
No, actually, I mean, if you read what they're saying, what they're going to do, I think it's kind of the opposite. They're saying they're going to expand oil production. I can't even remember the last announcements and all the investment they want to put into the oil industry. I'm betting that that won't materialize because they won't have to do it because oil prices will probably rise. And they won't really want to put more oil on the market. But you know, that's just a guess on my part. I can't really say. But in any case, I don't know, John. Did I answer? You think I answered most?
Yeah, you did. I mean, I guess, I mean, let me ask you this as a follow up. I mean, you know, what sign of you said the thing to do now is move on to the next phase and create kind of a new long-term development strategies. And I mean, it sounds like for you that the key there is, one key is adjusting the exchange rate in order to allow that to happen. But I mean, did you see signs that the government is embarking on strategies that you, as an economist, think are worthwhile?
Well, it's hard to say. I haven't, you know, this is the part where I didn't write that part of the paper either, because it's really hard for us to get enough data for that. In other words, to see, you know, how big the various programs are, the things they're trying to do in terms of, you know, experiments in industry, what they're trying to do with the steel industry. I really can't get enough solid information on it. We are going to try and do that. So I can't really say. I know they're looking in that direction. You know, I mean, I've met with, you know, ministers, for example, in the Ministry of Light Industry. They have some plans they're modest kind of plans, you know, to produce more, you know, to do some import substitution for government procurement, for example, where it's easy to do. I think they're moving slowly in these directions. That's why, you know, I pointed this out in the paper, but it's almost never been reported. But the private sector of the economy is actually a larger share of the economy than it was before Chavez took office. So the government has been slow and cautious in trying to, because they don't have the capacity, and they're aware of that, you know, the administrative capacity. And you know, that it takes for development planning, and they're not unique in Latin America, by the way, in that respect. I think it's true in almost all countries that I'm familiar with. And this is a problem. I mean, this is one of the reasons why you've had such slow growth in the whole region over the last 25 years. You know, this is something we write about all the time. It's been the worst performance in over a century in terms of long-term growth. It's terrible, a terrible failure. And part of the reason is you don't have the kind of development planning that you had in the 60s and 70s and even the 50s, when the economy grew about 6 or 7 times as fast as it did since 1980 on a per capita basis. So again, this is true in Venezuela, it's true regionally. And I can't really, you know, again, I can't really say definitively how well they're moving in the direction of
And why don't they have that development planning?
Why don't they?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's mostly because they've only had a few years of stability and they've concentrated on the macro policy, which is the most important. You know, if you get the macro policy right, at least you're going to have some growth and, you know, provide some improvement in people's lives. And from a political perspective, that's very important. And in some countries, that's going to be enough to last you quite a while. For Argentina, for example, is a relatively developed economy. The macro policy has done everything. They've been the fastest growing economy in the Western Hemisphere for 5 years now. They're still going to have to do something, though. They're going to need some development planning. You know, because you know, this is inevitable in the development process. Is you reach different stages, you reach a point where the structure of the economy has to change in some ways in order to go further, just to, you know, increase value added overall in the economy, and that's or you know, to shift to more value added production is what I mean, you know, higher value added production. That's what development is about. So how is Venezuela going to do that? I think they're going to, you know, that's why I focused on the macro, because the most important thing is that they're not going to get very far with this this kind of an overvalued currency in terms of development strategy and diversifying away from oil. That's what they're going to have to do. So I don't know when they're going to do that. I think they're reluctant to do it now, you know, devalue now, of course, because the inflation is high and they're trying to stabilize it. But that's going to be the first challenge. And then you do see these experiments. I mean, they have this joint production of computers with this Chinese company, for example. That looks promising to me. I don't know. I haven't seen any data on it recently. So I think that, you know, we'll just have to see. It's still early in the game.
Okay, let's take another question. Do we have any more questions at this point?
Yes, James Ingham here in BBC in Caracas.
Sure, go ahead, James.
I just want to constantly hear about sort of Hugo Chavez pledging money to other countries that he is keen to support, either sectors within those economies, like, you know, in America or Britain, helping the poor, or sort of his friends in Latin America, and the sort of pledges every week. I wonder whether you've been able to kind of keep track of them, and whether that's sort of sustainable with the amount of money that's available.
Yes, I have not been able to keep track of it. There was an AP reporter who tried to total it up, and she said it was something like $8 billion in pledges. You know, got to remember these loans to Argentina, for example. These are loans, so those are, that's not, you know, presumably that's not any kind of a giveaway.
But presumably long-term loans that reduced.
Yeah, they get I think they got 8% interest on the loan to Argentina, so that's pretty much market rates. Maybe it's
right.
a little, but not much if it is. So those aren't giveaways. I don't know how much it is. I mean, I that's one of the places where you really can't get good data. But I don't see it as being huge. I mean, if it's a few billion. I mean, it's somewhere in that range. It's single digits in the billions. And so that's really, it's hard for me to see how it hurts them. You know, they're, with the reserves they have and the rate of growth that they have and the inflation they have, it's not clear that they could really spend more, the government could spend more domestically without running into, you know, other problems, inflation problems.
I've seen a figure of something like nearly $50 billion pledged in the first half of this year. I mean, are those figures?
$50 billion of what? Pledges or actual disbursement?
On plans to, on sort of projects abroad, mixture of pledges and loans.
Outside the country?
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems ridiculous. I can't imagine it's anywhere near that.
Sure.
But again, you just have to, some of it have to go through and add them all up. And not everything that is, you know, pledged is going to happen, of course. You know, the Bank of the South, for example, their initial capital has already dropped some in terms of how much they were going to have and how much Venezuela's contribution is going to be. I don't think it's going to be that much. at least not that much more than the other countries, I should say, and that's pretty limited. So I don't know. I just haven't seen any evidence, though, that it's that large, that it would affect affect anything domestically in Venezuela.
Sure. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Do we have another question?
I have another one, which would be on spending. It appears that the rate of increase of spending is decreasing, if I'm correct, and correct me if I'm wrong. Would you think that spending is going to slow? Is it going to hinge very much on the future development of the price of oil to be sustainable at current growth rates? Or do you think this is also a sign of a gradual moderation in the direction of what you might term a second phase of the cycle?
Well, the rate of increase has to slow. This is, nobody could sustain this rate of increase of spending. So, yeah, I think this rate of increase is going to slow, but I don't expect overall spending to slow. I think it'll increase more moderately. And, yeah, I think the government recognizes, it is part of their attempt to stabilize inflation, which does seem to have stabilized around 19.4% over the last 3 months. And they want to bring it down. Their target is 12%. So, yes, absolutely, the rate of increase is going to slow. But I don't expect it to actually, the actual spending to be cut.
We have another question? You want to do any closing?
I think I might have to duck out.
What's that?
Sorry, it's James and Crux. I think I'm going to have to leave you now. But thank you.
Okay, okay. And anybody can leave, and we can wrap it up if there are no more questions, but it's fine. Anybody can keep going as long as you want. Thanks for calling in, too.
So do you want to ask anything to add?
I'm afraid I've also got to log off. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks
for calling in, Steph.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So do we have any further questions?